Connecting sleep to sports isn't easy, but here goes. Mattress Firm is America's neighborhood mattress store, and it should be your goal to check out the deals they have going on every day. Their mattresses are softer than your rival team's defense. They get a 10 out of 10. You'll love your new bed. Okay, all terrible dad jokes aside, head to mattressfirm.com/podcast and stretch your budget further. Hello and welcome to the MMQB 10 Things podcast. I am Gary Gramling. He is Andy Vinoit. We are coming off a weekend of insane NFL playoff football. And we're going to jump right into topic number one here because it is the game and the play that everyone is talking about.
Number one.
The Vikings with a miracle win over the Saints. And Andy, I'll put this out to start. The finish of this game, as far as excitement goes, let's just say overall excitement of the end of the game, where does it rank for you as far as postseason games? Can you think of one that was better?
I cannot think of one that was better. The one that comes closest to me was, last year's Super Bowl is kind of in a unique class, and that was almost a slow motion comeback by New England. It did have the final play, but that was in overtime, so you knew there'd be a final play. The one that maybe comes close, and I don't think it tops it because this game involves some kneel downs, controversial kneel downs, and it didn't have the back and forth several times like this one had, plus the ending, but it's the Baltimore-Denver divisional game in 2012, the year Baltimore went to the Super Bowl and they beat Peyton Manning's Broncos.
Yes, the big Jacoby Jones play.
Yeah, it was like a Hail Mary kind of play to Jacoby Jones along the sidelines. Kind of seems right side of the field, right sideline, like this one with Diggs here. And you know what, Gary, by the way, and I'd like to hear what game you propose that suggests maybe this, which one might be better. But I thought Marcus Williams on this play, he made a smart choice and executed very poorly. I think the reason he missed that tackle on Diggs was he was being conscious of trying to tackle him inbounds because he knew that would win the game for the Saints. And if you tackle Diggs out of bounds, you give Minnesota a chance at a game-winning field goal. I think it was a heads-up play with a disastrously poor execution by the rookie free safety.
Yeah, and before we move on, I'll nominate the Aaron Rodgers in Arizona, Packers Cardinals in Arizona, as far as, I don't know, it was sort of extended excitement, but I can't think of one that had a sort of, I don't know, 0-60 acceleration in just unexpected game finish than this one had. It must have been 1,000-1 at that point for the Vikings to win this game, and obviously they come away with it. As far as Marcus Williams, I was thinking, and look, he'll probably, talk about it at some point, but after he can't sleep for a couple months, I was wondering if he was concerned with hitting the defenseless receiver in that case, which at that point, obviously game would have been extended, they would have done the unplay down, and on top of that, you're moving the ball 15 yards, so it becomes a very makeable field goal. But just the fact that Diggs had the catch, it's kind of like something that was going to have a good ending for the Vikings unless Diggs was tackled in bounds, which, took some maneuvering. And obviously Williams did not go in there controlled enough to actually make the play. But if Diggs catches it and gets out of bounds, and when Williams first whiffed, my first thought was Diggs better step out of bounds right now before the clock expires. But obviously there's no one else to get him, so. He was right to run for that touchdown.
Yeah, that was my first thought, too. Yeah, it was my first thought, too. And I guess what we'll remember next time is, oh, that's right, Marcus Williams is always the last line of defense for New Orleans. And if he's whiffing on the tackle, you got a problem there. Great play by Diggs, heads up. And Case Keenum, say this about Case Keenum, and this was a double-edged sword. It has been in a few games this year, less than it has been this season than other seasons, though. But he is a gunslinger. He will take chances with the ball, and it's bizarre because Ryan Fitzpatrick's been this way over the years, and we say, well, Fitzpatrick, he's small in the pocket, and he doesn't have the arm strength to do that. to be a gunslinger. It's the same thing with Case Keenum, but it's worked out for Keenum this season, and it's worked out more than it hasn't. He had that we could be talking about Marcus Williams winning the game with the big interception and Case Keenum being the GOAT. And instead, it's the other way around. But Keenum made some really gutsy throws down the stretch outside the numbers to his right. And the other thing is he's willing to let go of the ball when he knows a hit is coming. It was Case Keenum has continuously outperformed his abilities this season. It's not just that he's running a really good offense by Pat Shurmur. I mean, he's doing that too. But he's been winning at times when the designs don't clearly win. He's been extending plays. He's been making something happen. And I think he's going to have to do that more, Gary, because the big hidden secret, and it's not a secret after this game, but it was evident on film late in the season, is Minnesota's offensive line's not the same. They lost Nick Easton at left guard. There's been a domino effect. They've reshuffled some spots. And that's that's almost a makeshift offensive line, and it's starting to show.
Yeah, and you know, it was a big-time throw by Keenum to Diggs on that last play. Those rainbow lobs that Keenum throws are they're an adventure. They're either they end with a spectacular finish or they end with a disastrous finish from his perspective. And we saw one of each. He had one to Thielen after the Marcus Williams interception later in that game. But are you concerned at all with the Vikings' ability to finish a game like this? Because, I mean, let's face it, they you know, without that play, that very unlikely play, they, you know, this, what we're talking about right now is the Vikings blowing a big lead at home when their defense had to hold on.
I am concerned because they don't have a running game that ices games like that. They've ran the ball a lot this season, but not a diverse or imaginative running game. There's nothing dynamic about their game. And we've talked about Latavius Murray over the years, and we don't think he, at least I think you agree with me on this, Gary, he's not a true power runner. He's not Mark Ingram. He's not Leonard Fournette, where he's going to turn a two-yard run into a 3 or 4 yard run, which is often the difference when you're protecting a lead. That's just not his style of play. He is better fit. He'd be a better fit in the Eagles' ground game, where there's a lot of options for you. But that's who they've got. That's who they play with. But now you've got that guy behind what we said is kind of a makeshift offensive line now. It was evident in this game they did not have the rushing attack to ice the game and maintain their big lead in the second half.
Yeah. Well, before we move on to the look ahead to next Sunday and the preview of the NFC title game, and by the way, we should have mentioned up top, but I will mention right now, the way we're going to format the show, we're going to touch on all four games from the weekend. We're going to preview each of the conference title games. We are going to do a roundup of all the coaching changes. We are going to do the we're going to group together the obits of the losing teams. So the four teams. Well, let's not call it an obit. Let's call it an off-season look ahead. Let's be a little more positive, and then we'll have weekly awards at the end, which you all really just came here for. So perhaps you just want to fast forward at this point, anyway.
Number two.
But for now, we'll move on to topic number two. That is the Eagles and the Falcons game from Saturday afternoon. This was Nick Foles making it work. The Eagles found a way to make it work with Nick Foles, which isn't shocking because, as we've talked about, they have the dominant defensive line. They have the expansive versatile running game, and they, after a really shaky start for Foles, they found some things that worked for him. And you know, by the time this game ended, there was just no throw I could think back to that was like, wow, that was a big time play that Foles had to make right there to keep it going. It was all kind of easy for him, which is, you know, yes, he made the throws, and yes, it's nice that they built it for him that way.
Smart. They've done that a number of times this year. We've talked about, you know, we've been all over Sean McVay and Pat Shurmur as these offensive whizzes. Doug Peterson is also in there. And if Philadelphia had won, if it had been a little better late in the regular season with Carson Wentz when he was out, I would have voted Doug Peterson coach of the year ahead of Mike Zimmer, because I think Peterson has done as good a job as anyone in football at putting together game plans. And it's been easier because he's had Carson Wentz, and there's everything on the table with Carson Wentz. Obviously, there's not everything on the table with Foles, but here we see him work around Foles' limitations. play to his strengths, get him comfortable, those run-pass options, that became the story of the game. That was very real, and it was enough. But really, this game was won on the other side of the ball, Gary. The Eagles held the Falcons to 10 points. They scored 15. So let's not act like Nick Foles won the day and Peterson. It was a great game plan, but without the defense doing what it did to what's still a very talented but ultimately underachieving offense, we're not having this conversation.
Yeah, and, you know, it was this Falcons offense. They picked up another punt turnover deep in opponent territory, and that was their touchdown drive, and obviously they moved it down the field late in the game. But, boy, what a kind of fitting end to a disappointing season for this Falcons offense. But, yeah, as far as the Eagles defense goes, I mean, we know they're dominant up front, but they really weren't exposed at all in the back seven. I know we talked a little bit last week about how, you know, is this a Tevin Coleman game? Do you get Coleman on those linebackers? And that's how the Falcons win this game. And obviously their corners have given up a couple of big plays, and it didn't happen. It just didn't happen to them on Saturday.
Those corners played very well. They got better as the game progressed. And it kind of was a Tevin Coleman game in the matter that Atlanta's only chance to run the ball, and I think they understood this, was to get the ball quickly on the perimeter. And we saw them doing all those down blocks with their wide receivers motioning tight to the formation and then crack back blocking on the defensive end. That's a great way. And then you pitch the ball, you sweep the ball, whatever it is, you swing it outside. That's a great tactic because it eliminates the entire defensive line from the run-stopping equation. It forces the linebackers and safeties to become the primary run defenders. You down block the defensive end. Everybody back blocks the defensive tackles. The ball's going outside, and it's someone else has to get them. But those someone else's for Philadelphia, they played very well. And Ronald Darby had a nice night after a tough start. Jalen Mills, you hardly knew he was on the field. They didn't throw at him a whole lot. And it's Atlanta's lack of chemistry or lack of fusion between the run game and the passing game ultimately showed up. And by the way, and I'm not big on criticizing play calls or coaching because there's so many factors that go into that we're not always aware of. I did not like the last play call, the 4th-and-2 play call, though. I was not a fan of the formation with Derek Coleman out wide on the left. Now you know the ball's not going left because they're not throwing to the fullback as an ex-ISO receiver. And now you know the ball is going right. And then they did that sprint out, but there was no misdirection element, no play action fake, nothing to slow down the defense, which is what Atlanta's whole offense has been about for a number of years. They just ran out, had Matt Ryan sprint out and make a contested throw, hoping to get Julio Jones. And look, Julio Jones 1-on-1's a fine scenario, obviously, but I thought there's more. You can get to it in different ways, and I didn't think it was a very creative ending to the game for Atlanta.
Well, I want to ask you two things about that. What's the reasoning behind, when the field is that tight, basically giving up one side of the field? Because that's what they're doing at that point. Not only with Coleman on that side, but obviously once you sprint out, unless you have some sort of throwback element in there, which they didn't, it's essentially, I mean, you're cramming just so many bodies into this one corner of the end zone, and it made little sense to me.
Me too, because those bodies also did not intersect. If I recall, everybody ran an outbreaking route, which is to present guys running into Ryan's vision on the sprint out. That's not an unusual design. But if it's 4th-and-2, you got to have rub routes, picks, stuff that backs the defense off. You know, challenge the defense. There was no Phil. If you, that's exactly what Philadelphia would take in that scenario. If they had to have 4th-and-2, you would want as a defense to have half the field defined before the snap, which it was with the fullback split out wide, and then all of the routes individually defined for you after the snap, and they got that as well.
Yeah, it was some dicey play calling down the stretch. And look, we've talked about this a couple times over the years because it's an obsession of mine, Julio Jones in the red zone, and in past years, he just hasn't been targeted very often. And last year, the Falcons had an excellent red zone offense, and you know, how much of it is the fact that they know a bunch of attention is going to be paid to Julio Jones, and now they basically work off of that assumption, and then you find good matchups elsewhere Whereas, especially, I noticed it more down the stretch, but especially in this game, I mean, they threw the fade to him on first down there. It seemed like, you know, it was sort of trying to force feed Julio down there, and I don't know if that's really, I mean, it's not what made them successful 2 years ago, and it seems like they're sort of trying to go that way for a reason that isn't very good, unless someone in the coaching staff has Julio on a fantasy team.
I don't disagree with you, and it'd be interesting to sit down and have a conversation with Steve Sarkisian or Dan Quinn and say, hey, you know, tell us what's really going on. What was all the thought process here on all this stuff and your red zone offense? Explain it to us, because they'll have good answers. These guys aren't just rolling the ball out and hoping it goes well, but it can sure look like that once in a while, and that can be frustrating if I'm a Falcons fan. It was an issue throughout the season. And it wasn't a strong playoff game for Atlanta's offense in the wild card round, and they couldn't overcome it this time in the divisional round. It was a much weaker offensive performance even in the divisional round.
Yeah. Well, we'll talk about the Falcons and look ahead to their offseason a little bit later in the show. For now, we're going to go to topic three, and we are previewing the NFC title game.
Number three.
This will be Vikings at Philadelphia. Let's start with the Eagles side of the ball here. Eagles on offense, I should say. What can you do at this point against a Vikings defense that, look, it's much better than the one you just faced? You know, Atlanta is a rising defense. The Vikings are already the best defense in football at this point. What kind of things can you do to try and find some success against this Minnesota D?
I think you have to do what you did Saturday night. You have to be highly schemed, multi-optional in your designs, involve Nick Foles with designs that get him identifying the defense pre-snap, you know, in those read option passes, those RPOs, read pass option plays. He's got to start getting a feel for the linebackers pre-snap to get an idea of what he might be doing, to give himself a little more information. Then you read the linebacker after the snap, of course. Mm-hmm. All that stuff, getting Foles involved with identifying the defense. Foles is good early in the down. He becomes a liability late in the down. And Minnesota's a hard defense to play against late in the down. They've got corners that can force you late into the down as well. I didn't think Philadelphia's wide receivers matched up well against Atlanta's cornerbacks, and I don't think those guys made any impact on that game, if I recall, Saturday night. They certainly don't match up well against Minnesota's cornerbacks. And so it becomes about beating the linebackers and safeties inside, just like it was last week. That's why you saw some of the RPO stuff. Even those RPOs get receivers the ball inside, and they're ultimately facing linebackers instead of corners. That's what it's got to be about, Gary, and it's going to be much harder because Atlanta, yeah, they're fast, they're athletic. Minnesota's also fast and athletic, and they're a lot more cohesive and aggressive in the way they play zone defense.
Yeah, you know, looking at from the Eagles' perspective, I just wonder if they had a couple of nice misdirection designs in this Falcons game too, and I wonder if they perhaps exhausted the bag of tricks at this point. Though we'll find out on Sunday. Other side of the ball here, obviously the Eagles have a huge advantage. Their defensive line going against this Vikings offensive line. If you're the Vikings, how do you approach it in a game where you're going to get beat up front?
Yeah, you are. That's hard. That is the showstopper to me. That's the biggest story heading into these championship rounds. That's the biggest mismatch that we're going to see in either of these final two games. And I don't know if there's a good answer for that. It's hard to play football when your offensive line is so overwhelmingly overmatched by the defensive line, and that's going to be the case. So Minnesota, they have to help guys. It's got to be 6 and 7 man protections. The question is, when your O-line is overmatched like that, do you run the ball or throw the ball more? You might think, well, you got to throw the ball because you want to protect your quarterback, but running the ball is going to be futile. I mean, it was against the Saints, and the Saints are a good, not great defensive line. The Eagles led the league in percent of runs that got tackled behind the line of scrimmage. It was nearly 1 in 5 runs this season were stuffed for a loss. You're going to get in some really bad third down scenarios if you try to establish the run game against them. I think what you need to do is establish the passing game and the quick passing game. And the argument against what I'm saying here, or let's figure it out. You and I can figure it out together, Gary. I think Minnesota's best chance is to win on third down and short, where they know they can get man coverage because they are excellent in man-to-man beater designs. And we saw that several times against the Saints. Think of Stephon Diggs running those shallow crosses underneath rub routes. They've been great at that all season long. So the discussion becomes, and this is a weird way to look at it, but if we're talking about maintaining offense, how do we get ourselves in third down and short, third down and three or two, something like that? Do we think that's running the ball, or what kind of passes do we think that is? And I don't know the answer to that.
I mean, you basically roll out Jerick McKinnon and hope you can get some stuff in space and isolate him on a linebacker maybe or something like that. I don't know, because I don't think you're gonna run it in there and pick up 3 or 4 yards with any sort of consistency.
I think you can also unbalance the formation, so put all your receivers to one side, all your tight ends to the other, and they've done that a little bit this year. And Thielen and Diggs are so interchangeable, they're going to be good in something like that. But by doing that, you identify the coverage pre-snap because of how the defense responds to the unbalanced look, and you can get the ball out quickly. And we're talking hitch routes, Y stick patterns, like Kyle Rudolph running 5 yards and just turning around. A really ball control passing game on first and second down with some play action sprinkled in, because that's the smart thing to do. You always want to have that, and that can kind of give you a sense of run-pass balance, even if you're going to be very pass-heavy. Something like that, though. The Vikings have to get into man-to-man situations. They have to force the Eagles into man coverage because that's their best chance of winning through play design.
If you're the Vikings, are you satisfied playing a little bit of field position in this one, even though you probably have the better quarterback, let's say, and better overall defense? Or do you feel like you have to sort of be the aggressor in this game?
I play field position. Absolutely. I play to the strength of my defense and trust in those guys. That's who got you here. That's how you're going to have to win. Look, we're treating the Vikings like they're a team that's lucky to be here. They're not. They're a genuine number two seed. They could be a number, 14-3 on the season. They're just caught in a bad matchup where their offensive line in its current state is a little wobbly, and they happen to be facing the league's best defensive line. So it's a weird lopsided event for the Vikings this week. They could very well be the best team in the NFL right now. They've got to find a way around that one glaring matchup. I think you play field position, you trust your defense against Nick Foles, and you trust that the rest of the game will sort itself out with that matchup taking center field for you.
All right. Well, Andy, before we move on, you know, we all live busy lives, and unfortunately there's not enough hours in the day to get everything done, so thank goodness there's Freshly, the easiest and most convenient way to eat healthy no matter what life throws your way. Freshly's team of chefs create all-natural, gluten-free dinners and deliver them fresh to your door. So even if you get stuck at work late, maybe you're breaking down some film for the conference title games coming up, you can still get home to a delicious dinner cooked by a chef. No more worrying about having to figure out what's for dinner, and especially no mess to clean up after. I personally love getting the Freshly. Buffalo chicken with the loaded cauliflower is pretty much as good as it gets. It's delicious, and it's a little bit nutritious, too. Their menu is created by chefs for people who want to eat healthy but are living busy lives and don't always have the time for shopping, cooking, or cleaning. The best part about Freshly is the number of comfort meals they currently have that are also super healthy, like the aforementioned buffalo chicken or perhaps the chicken parm. Customize your weekly meals from their constantly changing, rotating menu of more than 30 chef-crafted options. There's no weekly commitment, so you only get deliveries when you want them. Every single meal comes with a detailed and easy-to-read overview of each ingredient featured in the meal. Trust me, there is nothing better than knowing that no matter what happens in my daily life, that I have a chef-cooked dinner waiting for me at home. Check out this week's menu created by Freshly's chefs and get $25 off your first order of 6 chef-cooked dinners plus free shipping by going to freshly.com/10things. That's 10things. You'll feel so relieved to come home to a chef-cooked meal every night with Freshly. That's freshly.com/10things, 10things, for $25 off your first order. Order today to see what life's like when you no longer have to think about dinner.
Number 4.
All right, topic number four here. We are moving on to the AFC side of it, and we're going to start with the Sunday game. That was the Jaguars going back to Pittsburgh, and much to many people's surprise, though not literally everyone's surprise, Jacksonville wins this one. They win it in a very Jaguars kind of way where they got a lead and simply maintained it throughout the game, and that meant scoring points as the Steelers scored points. I mean, the Jaguars literally never trailed in this game, and I think kind of the nice thing is the Jaguars have had a couple of games this year where they've scored 40-something points. When they get a lead, it's not just that they get to run the ball. They basically have all the things you can do when you're expected to run the ball. You can throw it on first down and catch someone off guard. You can run your play action like that nice little play action touchdown to Tommy Bohannon, the fullback. You can do those things, whereas if you're down 7-10 points, those things are maybe not available or perhaps not as effective.
Yeah, and I snickered when you said Jaguars. It's 45-42. A Jaguars game at 45-42. But I know what you're saying. I agree with you. The way it was put together was Jacksonvillian. And that Tommy Bohannon play is a great illustration of where Jacksonville is. The theme of these playoffs, where these championship playoffs, Gary, is offensive design. You've got Josh McDaniels, who might be the best in the business. It helps that he has Tom Brady. We've talked about Pat Shurmur. I think he's done the best this year of all offensive coordinators. We just talked about Doug Peterson. I said I'd probably put him a slot ahead of McVay in Coach of the Year voting. And then Nathaniel Hackett, a good friend of McVay's, incidentally, another young coach, and what he's doing with that offense in the play action game. Bortles is a good play action passer, and that was true back in the early years of his career, 2015, when he led the league in touchdowns that year. Bortles has had a very good career as a play action passer. You still see some inconsistencies when he's throwing the ball, but conceptually it plays well to his slower developing style of throwing, and when he gets comfortable with it, they're hard to contend with. And Bortles got comfortable with it early in the game because they had those designs for him. They came out killing the Steelers with play action, and then they capped it off with that play to Bohannon, which was brilliant because, especially in the red zone, defensive coverages are not set up to defend vertical routes by the fullback. You don't assume the fullback goes vertical because he has to work his way through traffic, and he's got extra space to cover because he starts 4 yards deep in the backfield, so it's hard to get vertical. It was a great play design that they've basically been setting up all year by running the ball out of those two-back, two-tight-end sets.
Yeah, nice one to pull out of your pocket there. As far as the defense goes, it was a little bit of an unusual game. You have the Antonio Brown injury, and Antonio Brown was limping around early on, and it was kind of like, okay, well, here's a decoy. And then Brown ends up making a couple plays. Brown was not 100%, but he's so good when he gets around the ball and all the little subtle things he does, those little push-offs that maybe he doesn't get called for all the time, but he gets the benefit of the doubt there, and he still makes plays once he's around the ball. But I feel like the Jaguars almost didn't know exactly what they wanted to do with Antonio Brown after he caught that touchdown late in the second quarter there.
You know, I think what happened, the way I interpreted the whole game, because don't these playoff weeks feel slow? Like it felt like these wild card games were 10 years ago, and then we finally get to the division games. And over the course of these long weeks, we come up with storylines and things to talk about, and one of the storylines this week will be, hey, is Jacksonville's defense starting to leak? They gave up all those points to the Steelers. Ben Roethlisberger had a ton of plays on them. I thought the Brown catches and the Le'Veon Bell touchdown, the Martavis Bryant touchdown, I thought it was all fine defense and unbelievably good offense, just four great touchdown catches. I thought Bouye was fantastic in coverage on Brown a number of times. I thought Jacksonville did what they normally do. They looked like Jacksonville. Pittsburgh just made some incredible raw talent plays. I don't think there's anything to worry about with the Jaguars heading into the championship game.
Yeah, I don't think so either. And we'll get to that championship game preview in a moment.
Number five.
But before we do, let's talk topic number five here. Let's talk what happened Saturday night. Not a shocker. The Titans scored first in this game, and that was nice, and that got everyone a little bit interested. Once Jack Conklin went down and the right side of that line got a little bit leaky and the run game never got established, this one got away pretty quickly from Tennessee. I don't know. I don't know what to say about this game other than it was quite expected for the final, let's say, 48 minutes.
Yeah. Story of the season, though. I mean, Conklin going down, yeah, it's too bad you don't want to ever see a guy get hurt, but that didn't change the game. Tennessee's ground game has been inconsistent all year. It was good against Kansas City, who's a bad run defense. New England's a totally different style of run defense, schematically and personnel-wise. I didn't think Tennessee's run game would match up well at all, especially the three-wide receiver run game that they had success with in the wild card round. So now it becomes a Marcus Mariota game. And he's been inconsistent, and we saw that continue Saturday night. Inconsistent in the timing of his dropbacks, his field vision. I don't think he's identifying the defense early in the down or before the snap, and you're seeing a very reactionary quarterback as a result of that. And that's disappointing because that more than the interceptions suggest regression. The interceptions are a symptom. This is part of the disease, quote-unquote. Mariota didn't read the field particularly smoothly, and New England's a defense, they're very straightforward and fundamentally sound. Straightforward's the wrong word. They're very fundamentally sound, and they play straightforward stuff with little wrinkles built in here or there. They're a nuanced defense, and Tennessee really wasn't competitive against it.
Yeah, and we're going to talk Titans a little bit more because as we're taping here, the reports are that Mike Mularkey will get an extension, which it's a surprise to me, but we'll talk about that a little bit later in the show when we do the Titans offseason look ahead.
Number six.
But as for now, let's go topic number six. Let's talk about this AFC title game. I mean, look, the big matchup's going to be Tom Brady in this offense versus the Jaguars defense. That's what everyone's going to be interested in seeing. And how does this match up? I mean, the Patriots are so unique offensively and they're so diverse with what they can do offensively. Is there a soft spot in this Jaguars defense that they can sort of needle at a little bit?
No, there's no soft spot. So what you have to do, and the reason there's no soft spot is there's too much speed and athleticism at every level, and it's hard to get mismatches. Even they'll get Danny Amendola and James White in a favorable angle, but they'll get those guys matched up favorably against Miles Jack and Telvin Smith underneath, out of spread formations a few times because New England always does. But they're not going to line up and play that way every snap like they did against Tennessee. You can't do that against Jacksonville. They're too good in their zone awareness. They are great with their chemistry and their collective speed. You're not going to dink and dunk out of a horizontal offense against them. And that really isn't how New England plays. They went back to that against Tennessee, which was a lot of fun to watch Saturday night. It was like a step back in time from 2 years ago, 3 years ago, that kind of Julian Edelman-style Patriots offense. Mm-hmm. But the one that's going to have to beat Jacksonville is the one we've seen all of 2017. Running formations, power run game, run pass balance with downfield shots. And those receivers do not match up well to those big corners outside. So the downfield shots have to be to Gronkowski, or they have to be on really deep play action stuff where you're attacking the safeties. Attacking Jacksonville's safeties and linebackers through the air, that's going to be the key for the chunk plays that I think you need against Jacksonville. That and running the ball. It's a better Jaguars run defense with Marcell Dareus. It's still not a perfect one, though, and I would imagine New England will be satisfied averaging 3.5 yards a carry and carrying it 30 times against them.
Yeah, Deion Lewis had a big night on Saturday. James White is getting involved again. Burkhead was out, obviously. I mean, is there something they can do there with the passing game? Is that an edge to the Patriots when you have a White or a Lewis going out in a pass route against this Jaguars defense?
It can be, but again, you know, look at the first interception that Roethlisberger, I think his only interception that he threw on Sunday to Miles Jack on that play where Jack just beat, I think it was McDonald, the tight end, on the out route. You know, you got to be careful about those guys. Telvin Smith, those guys are ball-hawking linebackers. And, yes, you can get them because it's big-time talent with James White that we're talking about. It's a good system. Brady's always going to be on schedule. I just don't think that can be the foundation. I think if you want to find another way to beat Jacksonville, let's say the running game really isn't working and run-pass balance has to go out the window, and what do we do now? that no huddle, hurry up approach could be a solution, because you do know what Jacksonville's going to present to you. It's almost always going to be cover three of some sort. And when you go no huddle against those vanilla execution-based defenses, they become even more predictable, and the corners stay on the same side all game. You know the matchups. You can really dictate it. So go hurry up against them. Let Tom Brady decide the game at the line of scrimmage and dictate things. That could be one way. The other reason I think hurry up might be beneficial is Jacksonville, they sub a little bit, but they're not a big rotation team. They're not like the Eagles where they have two sets of defensive lines and they change them like hockey rotations. They don't sub a whole lot, and you can wear those guys down. And not many guys on those rosters have played until late January or mid-January. This is now going to be, what, the 19th game of the season for the Jaguars. They've played all their starters and a lot of them for almost the whole duration of the game. You know, I would try to make fatigue set in on them and go fast.
Now, looking at the other side of the ball, we have the Patriots basically just shut down Derrick Henry and that Titans power running game last week. Does that bode well for going against this Jaguars defense, where obviously running the ball is paramount for what they do?
Yeah, it's definitely paramount. And Jacksonville, it's not a lot of gimmicks. It's line up, run behind the double teams, and let Leonard Fournette lower his shoulder and gain a few extra yards, which wasn't he great, by the way, Gary, against Pittsburgh on Sunday morning early in that game?
He was. Sunday morning? Oh, you got the
time Sunday
zone
morning
difference.
For me. I'm out in the mountain. I'm out in the mountain time zone. Sunday early afternoon for most of our listeners. I thought he was great. I think you've got to get him up to those linebackers. New England is so difficult to run against. They're very gap sound, and the part of their defense that gets overlooked. I don't know if Alan Branch will play in this game. He was borderline for the divisional game, and he wound up being inactive. But he's a tremendous run defender. Ricky Jean-Francois has size, but the two guys that really stand out are Lawrence Guy, and then Malcolm Brown, who's one of the league's better run defenders, and nobody talks about him. That's a hard group, and then you factor in the guys setting the edges, and James Harrison played well setting the edge. That's not as big a deal against Jacksonville's ground game because it's already an interior rushing attack anyway. But I don't know, Gary, if the smart plan, if your idea is we're just going to overpower the Patriots, I don't think that's a defensive line you can overpower, even though you did just dominate a much more talented Steelers defensive line. You also got, and we haven't talked about this, you also got to face a Steelers defense, a Steelers team that was clearly overlooking you, which was embarrassing, as David DeCastro said, for a playoff loss. New England's not going to be overlooking Jacksonville, obviously.
Yeah. A little bit of overlooking, maybe. I think that got a little bit overplayed.
Well, sure, it always gets overplayed, and I'm contributing to that right here. I understand that, but you didn't think it looked like just coming out that Pittsburgh looked like the team that whose coach had been talking about the AFC Championship weeks ago, and whose players Mike Mitchell, Le'Veon Bell, those guys are talking about next week in the Patriots. I mean, that you didn't think the Steelers looked like a team that was less prepared to play than the Jaguars early in the game?
I think they look like a team that never figured out what to do post Ryan Shazier and probably underestimated what Blake Bortles was going to be able to do. I don't know. If there's any underestimating, I think everyone sees Bortles as a caricature where he's a guy who almost like he's physically incapable of completing passes, and it's you know, when it's easy. When it's the play action stuff on first down and you don't defend it well and they're easy throws. I mean, you know, he can beat you. He can throw downfield. They took a bunch of downfield shots and finally got one when they needed one. I think,
but that's not
where
Bortles beating them.
It's not Bortles, but it's Bortles beating them in situation. I thought Bortles beat them in situational football, or I should say the Jaguars' passing game beat them in situational football. The Jaguars were like 8 for 14 on third down, and they were not a bunch of third and short conversions. It was a lot of balls thrown well short of the sticks that whether it was T.J. Yeldon or one of the tight ends or Bortles had one of the long scrambles on a third down play. It was a lot of stuff like that.
Yeah, you're right. Jacksonville outplayed them, and I'll be interested to watch the film on that game the more we're talking about it, because it'll be interesting to see what Bortles saw and really what they were asking of him. We know what he's throwing, and it was, you're right, short of the sticks, kind of a controlled passing game. And my sense is that's what the film will show. But you can't see all the route combinations and the timing of the patterns until that All-22 comes out. And that'll be revealing, because I felt like Jacksonville hid Bortles in this one, which I think's the right way to do it. I don't think Bortles is as bad as other people think, but I think he is a QB you have to hide. But it's possible they didn't. We'll have to see. When you throw on early downs, that's a great way to play with a quarterback you're wanting to hide.
Yeah. Yeah, overall, I think we sort of got back to that topic number four, Jaguars-Steelers game. It feels like the Patriots got a nice little tune-up with this Titans team for what they're going to see next Sunday in the AFC title game, as far as the overall stylistic play goes.
Yeah.
All right, Andy, we're going to talk coaches. We're going to talk off-season look ahead for a couple teams. But first, I want to go back to Mattress Firm. Let's keep the ball rolling, shall we? The base for my argument is simple. Your bed budget can go further when you're shopping at America's Neighborhood Mattress Store. It's a true home run, and you'll have a ball. They're the head coaches when it comes to mattress expertise, but know this. They are more than mattress experts. They have a game plan that helps you transform your mattress into a bed, from adjustable bases and sheets to headboards and bedroom decor. They have you literally and figuratively covered up like your favorite cornerback. Go to mattressfirm.com/podcast to see what deals are happening as I read this sentence to you. They even offer you a 120-night sleep trial to ensure perfection at a 120-night low-price guarantee, so you know you paid the perfect price. Talk about a 1-2 punch, a knockout, if you will. Score big with a perfect bed. Head to mattressfirm.com/podcast to get the play-by-play on how you can monumentally improve your sleep today, tonight, and tomorrow.
Number 7.
All right, topic number 7, Andy, we're going to talk a little bit of coaching here. The one head coach hire that has happened, and there will be some more this week, so we apologize if you are listening in the future, but at the time we're taping, it was Matt Nagy to the Chicago Bears. This seems like a pretty good fit with Mitchell Trubisky.
Yeah, I agree with you, because I think Trubisky's career will come down to how well he executes on timing and rhythm throws. He's going to have to be Kirk Cousins style. Alex Smith's not a true timing and rhythm quarterback, but he, you know, something along those lines, closer to that. I think he can be a better version of those guys. And I think Nagy, with what he'll do, and it's going to be an Andy Reid style offense, we can at least assume, because that's the only guy Nagy's ever worked for in the NFL, dating back to Philadelphia and into Kansas City years. I think that's the right solution for Trubisky. It's interesting to me still, Gary, that they would go offensive-minded coach, just given that's the one stadium in the league where it truly is hard to be an offensive team in the sense of how we think of offensive teams in today's NFL. But you do have a quarterback. Every team has to build around their quarterback. It's a young QB, and it's not a bad idea to find someone who's going to run the right system for him. And remember, systems are what define coaches, and the motivation and the emotional side of football, all that follows. When you put players in the right position to win, they'll listen to you as a coach, and you'll get their respect, and you get team chemistry that way. And I think Nagy can give them that.
Yeah, I wonder if there's a little bit of a – well, I'm sure they thought about all of this before they made the hire, but – we talked for so many years about, you know, Andy Reid, that Chiefs offense, it's so well designed. You don't need great wide receivers to be able to operate with that offense. And if you are talking about a roster that lacks great wide receivers, that is the Chicago Bears. So maybe that's not as dire a need. It's still a dire need, but it's not as dire a need as maybe it looked like a couple of weeks ago.
One thing they have, though, they've had this for as long as Reed's been in Kansas City almost, or at least as long as we've been saying, hey, you don't need wide receivers, is Travis Kelce. Mm-hmm. And there's no anything remotely close to Travis Kelce on that Bears roster. So tight end, even though they signed Deion Sims to a nice contract last year, tight ends a need, and I don't know what this year's draft is like, but if you can find an athletic, versatile tight end, that's something that will make what you just said true. If you don't, then you're going to have to find something to do at wide receiver. It's easier to find, I would imagine, it's easier to find a good wide receiver than it is to find a great tight end.
Yeah, and look, a year ago they spent a top 50 pick on Adam Shaheen, who was a D2 guy, converted basketball player out of Ashland College. So obviously they know him much better than any of us do because he just didn't play that much as a rookie. But perhaps there is some untapped potential there if you're looking. And obviously, Tariq Cohen is a guy who certainly fits what that Andy Reid type system does. But they also, interesting side note, they brought in Mark Helfrich, who, if you are a college football fan, you will remember him running Oregon's offense. He was head coach there. He was offensive coordinator and quarterbacks coach there. He worked with Marcus Mariota, so maybe you have some new ideas being infused, and you get something a little more interesting with that old, Andy Reid style system.
Yeah, misdirection, and we'll see. And I don't, Shaheen, he didn't strike me as that type of multi-dimensional tight end. I think my sense is he's more of an inline tight end. I could be wrong. You're right. They know more about him. Surely there's untapped potential because of where he came from and how little he's played. But even so, finding a second one is also important, too. The Chiefs did a lot with two tight end sets, three tight end sets. Really, that's a big part of their offense. I think in that system with Mitchell Trubisky and how good he is throwing potentially down the seams, I don't think you can have too many tight ends unless you've got eight. Eight's too many.
Number eight.
Let's go on to topic number eight. This is going to be it's a offense coordinator roundup here. Lots of news in the offense coordinator world. Let's start in Seattle. Daryl Bevel is out. Rumors are at the time of our taping that Brian Schottenheimer will replace him. But I want to throw this at you, Andy, and I want to know what you think about it. Seattle obviously has issues with personnel. They have a bad offensive line. Once Chris Carson went down, they really didn't have any great answers at running back. So you have no running game. You have no ability to protect Russell Wilson. Wilson obviously can mitigate a lot of that with his ability to run around and make plays. I wonder if Seattle saw what Houston did when they came in with Deshaun Watson and they had revamped that offense. They had a bad offensive line too, but they had revamped it. They had all this misdirection, all these bells and whistles built into their offense, and they torched that Seahawks defense. And that was back when Richard Sherman was still healthy and Earl Thomas was in the lineup. And I think Cam Chancellor was still playing at that point. I might be wrong. Earl Thomas, I guess, never went away this year. But they torched that Seahawks offense. I wonder if in the back of Pete Carroll, John Schneider's minds, they kind of said, this is the kind of thing we should be doing with the personnel that we have.
Well, and let's also – they fired Tom Cable, an offensive line coach.
Yes.
And I don't know Tom Cable. I don't know how he works with them. I think he's respected around the league. But let's just state some facts here. Because the narrative is Seattle is a bad offensive line. And it's true. It has not performed well. That offensive line also has a top shelf in terms of salary and a former first-round pick, veteran left tackle, and Dwayne Brown. It's got a second-round center in Justin Britt, a second-round guard in Ethan Posick, and a first-round right tackle in Jermaine Ifedi. Now, how many offensive lines in the NFL are full? And the other guy, by the way, is Luke Jokel, who is a first-round pick. So all five starters are former first- or second-round picks. Half of them are recent first- or second-round picks. How many offensive lines in the NFL have that? So to say it's a bad line, I think a coaching change is not a bad idea because they've invested in the O-line, and these guys didn't just lose their talent when they got to the NFL. Now, maybe they're not NFL guys. Maybe they were misscouted. That happens too. But the odds of Seattle whiffing on every offensive lineman they've ever touched in the draft versus maybe it's just time to change how we approach these guys and deal with it, I like that they're making the change. I understand it. Whoever they have at coordinator, it's going to be Brian Schottenheimer, it sounds like. It's going to the whole job comes down to how you play with Russell Wilson. And Russell Wilson will inherently make your offensive line look worse at times. And now he'll also overachieve when your offensive line breaks down and actually is bad. He can still win the play for you. That's why he's special. But that runaround style, Michael Vick used to do the same thing. Your offensive line always looks worse than it is because the quarterback, you don't know where he's going to be, and it creates some pressure, and there's a frenetic feel. And that's the issue with that offense, and that's not going away either unless you find a coordinator who's going to bang the tables and say, absolutely, Russell Wilson, you're playing on schedule. We're going to make you. We're going to spread out into empty, and you've got no choice but to throw the ball quickly, which Seattle did with him for a little while, and it went really well. If you're not going to do that, though, if you give him any leash at all, you're getting a randomized Sandlot-style offense, and the coordinator is going to have to design accordingly, and that's not easy to do.
All right. So I get the sense you're not feeling my Texan-style offense here. But let me ask it, because that was...
Yeah, I'm sorry. Well, I didn't even respond to that.
You were so angry about Tom Cable that you never even got to my proposed offense. This interview has gone horribly for my... offensive coordinator role in Seattle, but I like that Seattle offense when they went empty and had Wilson doing sort of the point guard thing, and then obviously he could sprinkle in his out of structure playmaking. But why did they go away with it? Is it something that could work in the future, or was it the kind of thing where they broke it out mid season that one year, and you know it just took a little bit of time? Everyone saw it for a couple of weeks, and then when they came back next season. It just wasn't, they had lost the element of surprise with it.
Yeah, I don't know. That's a great question. They went to it in week 12 against the Steelers. Was it 2014 or 20? I think it was 2015 season, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was when Jimmy Graham got hurt. And it was in the game Jimmy Graham got hurt. It was like all of a sudden, just overnight, they just changed. And they went to that spread offense, and it worked extremely well. And Wilson, to my immense surprise, I didn't think he could play on schedule like that. He did play on schedule. And what you have to do to make it so he can see consistently is really spread the field horizontally so that he can – it spreads out the defense and becomes easier to see and decipher and all that. Look, I understand why you might not play that way, though, too. Let's not get confused. It's Russell Wilson, and his talent and his sandlot ability is immense. It's probably the best of all time for running around and making plays. Anytime you've got someone with a unique skill set that's the best of all time, I understand playing to that. The discussion, though, what Seahawks fans have to understand and what the Daryl Bevel haters have to understand is that style of play, even if it's from the best guy of all time, it's inherently inconsistent. So you have to, because other guys can't play that way, and you can't draw up plays consistently that way. There's just too many unknowns involved with it. So you've got to find a way to mitigate that inconsistency. Running the ball, that's a big factor in it. That's a huge factor in it. And really, this team hasn't been the same since Marshawn Lynch was gone. But you've got to find a way around that. And that's the discussion. If you're not going to find a way around it, then you do have to put Russell in the spread system. But going halfway and doing half measures, that's not going to work. That's where you're going to get Doug Baldwin, you know, passive-aggressively griping in the media that play calling is not the issue. That's where you're going to see an offense that had less than 160 yards of total offense in two of its last three outings.
All right, well, let's go out to Carolina, another uniquely talented quarterback out there. Mike Shula and Ken Dorsey, Shula offensive coordinator, Dorsey the quarterback's coach, they had been with Cam Newton since his rookie year. They are both out, and Norv Turner and his son Scott Turner will coach quarterbacks and specifically coach Cam Newton. They are in. Yeah, we talked a ton about Cam and the Panthers offense and what direction they want to go in and you know the quick strike elements they sort of sprinkled in early and didn't work out and they got away from it and sort of rolled it back to what they had been. It seems like Norv Turner and we'll see, he's been out for a year and a half, but it seems like he is more of the latter. And I mean I don't know. I don't know if there were problems with Shula's specific play calling, but it seems like this offense as a whole will probably look a lot like it did under Shula for the most part.
I agree. I liked it. I was surprised about the Shula firing. I wasn't big on it, but then I liked the Norv Turner hiring, and those things are not contradictory. You can like one guy who's fired and like the guy who replaces him, and I do, because I believe strongly, and I think Ron Rivera kind of does too now, that you have to have a downfield intermediate to deep style passing game with Cam Newton and extra bodies in protection and deeper dropbacks, all those things, and play to his power throwing style. You can't have a quick precision timing passing game. And Shula had talked about last offseason wanting to do more of that. And maybe he was really wanting to do more of that, and Rivera just saw differently. I don't know. Turner's a good fit for Newton stylistically as a passer. The question, Gary, becomes what will Turner do with Newton in the ground game? Because Mike Shula is a hard act to follow for run game designs, and he was very good with using Newton in the running game. But having said that, Carolina's ground game, when you take Newton out of the equation, and you still have to do that, he can't run the ball every play, it was not good. It was the second to worst in the league in efficiency, in fact, of just handing the ball to the running backs. So maybe it was time for a change, but Newton has to be a big part of the running game continued moving forward. Norv Turner has to do that. That's probably not in his nature, but from what I've heard, Norv Turner's amenable to new ideas, and he's pretty flexible changing with the times.
Yeah, and they, I mean, I don't know. I guess when I look at that roster, they're not horrible up front, but they're not good up front. And I wonder if they're just going to have the same issues that they had this year, even when they went back to, you know, Cam and a lot of those design runs and getting the ball downfield more. A lot of the problems stem from troubles on the offensive line, and they have some work to do up there, and I'm not sure there are any obvious solutions for them going forward, especially they're going to have to pay Andrew Norwell this offseason. So,
and I could not believe he got first team all pro, and I'm not ripping him at all. He was fine this season, but to give some point of reference to that, because I was voting for that, I did a name search on my film notes on anyone I thought might be an all pro at any position, and took forever. It was a pain, but I enjoyed it. And when I searched Andres Pete at left guard for the Saints, I think he showed up 26 times, and there were probably 15 notes of highlights or mentionables about him. And I did Roger Saffold for the Rams, and he showed up less than Pete, but he had some really dynamic notes, maybe 15, 16 returns on his name, and 6 or 7 big-time highlight things, and some lowlights for Saffold, and that's why I ultimately voted for Pete. But when I searched Andrew Norwell's name in my film notes, he showed up 4 times. And that means he didn't get beat in pass protection. So that's good. It's not bad mm-hmm. to not be in the film notes or not stand out on film as a lineman. But there was nothing special about him in the running game. We just said they had maybe the worst running game in the NFL this year, especially when you take out Newton's playmaking. I don't know where voters got it in their heads that they're voting Andrew Norwell at left guard. I think it comes down to people don't follow offensive line play. There's no way to measure them. And you ask around, hey, who are you voting for at left guard? Oh, I got this guy. And you go, okay, that's good. At least I can vote for him and not feel alone. I think that kind of thing can go on sometimes. I think that's what happened with Norwell. If you have to pay him big money, I'm not paying him huge money to stay. I'll pay him like an upper tier starter, but I'm not making him one of the 3 or 4 highest paid guards in the NFL if it takes that.
My confession is that I did not look at the All-Pro teams at all. I don't know. I'm not going to say I don't care. It's just not high enough on my priority list this time of year to go through it. But I was quite surprised when you just revealed that he was first team. I thought he was. That's it. I thought he was good. I think he's a B+ lineman. I think he's a guy you want to keep around and have in your team and all that stuff. But that's kind of horrible news for the Panthers, because now he probably will get some big offers out there by someone being like, oh, we can add a first-team All-Pro guard.
Yeah, he will. That stuff does happen. And look, I'm not saying this to say he's bad. Or I don't mean to – this is not necessarily an anti-Norwell rant, but The idea, people are going to look at this Panthers line and say, well, two Khalil brothers. I know the Khalil brothers, so they must be good, and they were both first-round picks. Norwell was first-team All-Pro. A bunch of people said a few years ago that Trey Turner is the second coming of Larry Allen, so that must be true because I know his name, though he must be great, even though he can't block power defensive tackles anymore. And there's going to be this thinking that Carolina's got a potentially dominant offensive line, when in reality they've got a very average offensive line, and a lot of these guys are they're certainly closer to average than great. Now, they might be closer to good than average, but B+, that's a fair grade if you're being generous. I think these are B- linemen across the board, even C+ linemen in some spots.
Yeah. No, again, and to reiterate what you said, Andrew Norwell's good. I actually, before you mentioned that All-Pro thing, I would have considered him probably underrated. I didn't realize people thought that highly of him. That's a bit too high, though.
It's the old Bill Simmons thing. So underrated, you become overrated.
Yes. That's kind of spot on right here. The last move we're going to talk about here, Rick Dennison out in Buffalo. Brian Daboll, the most recently University of Alabama offense coordinator, he comes in there. The Dennison thing, it's not that surprising. Again, they're a team in transition. They sort of settled for – it's pretty clear this regime wasn't really interested in building around Tyrod Taylor, so they didn't build an offense that was suited exactly to what Taylor did, maybe like they did under the Rex Ryan regime. But it seemed like it kind of settled on Dennison anyway. It seemed like they shopped around for a couple of guys and struck out, and Dennison was the guy they ended up with. And I don't know, I didn't really have I have a lot of opinions about the Bills. I didn't really have a strong opinion one way or another about Rick Dennison. I thought he was kind of nondescript, and if you're looking long term, I didn't really have an issue with what he did this year. If you really wanted to win with Tyrod Taylor, you probably should have done the same things that they did under Greg Roman and Anthony Lynn.
I thought he did a nice job, Dennison, with some of their play-action stuff, and he really did a great job, especially early in the season before teams kind of caught on to this, was manufacturing offense with play-action rollouts, something they call three-level stretches, crossing patterns with a guy deep, a guy in the 15 yards downfield, and a guy as a check down underneath. It beats a lot of zone coverages. I like their offense. Here's what I think happened. Sean McDermott got to Buffalo. Yeah, he probably made some calls. Maybe he didn't get some of the guys he wanted. I don't know. I'm guessing on that. But he said, well, we have Tyrod Taylor. What can we do with that? We got to find something that puts him on the move, and we have to find something that plays to play action because that's the only chance with him. Well, we need a zone running game then. Well, who coaches a zone running game? Well, Rick Dennison does. Let's hire Rick Dennison. They do that. They get there. It goes okay at first, and then about 5 weeks into the season, they realize, hey, our offensive line really isn't suited for a zone more of a man-blocking offensive line like what Anthony Lynn did, and now all of a sudden you got an offense that doesn't work, and Taylor's not playing well, and you bench Taylor and go with Nathan Peterman because you're probably not committing to the zone running game. You got to try some new stuff on the fly. The whole thing's just a big toss-up. They've don't got the coaching and the quarterback and the rest of the all on the same page, and so they're getting rid of the quarterback most likely, and they decided they're getting rid of the coach. It's easier to do those two things than it is to retool five offensive linemen who, by the way, are not very – they're pretty good. They're not a bad offensive line there. So I think that's where they're at, and it'll be really interesting to see what Daboll has in store for them. It's been a while since he's been in the NFL.
Yeah, and obviously he's a guy who, you know, he has a long stint in the NFL with his resume, most recently with the Patriots as a tight ends coach and an offensive assistant there. He was a coordinator. Kansas City, Miami, and Cleveland in the last decade. So, yeah, play calling experience there. Any opinions on him, Andy?
No, I really don't know much. I've never met him. I don't know a lot about him. He's kind of hidden. He was a coordinator years ago, and then he got tucked away as an assistant on some of those staffs you just named. He's basically a head coach in this scenario because McDermott's going to be working primarily with the defense, I would imagine. Although McDermott's got Leslie Frazier running the defense, so you can turn the room over to him and let him install the game plan. Maybe McDermott will be a little more hands-on with the offense. Maybe that was part of the Daboll decision. I don't know. But I have no thoughts on Dable. I'll be interested to see what he brings to the table, and I'd love to meet him at the Combine this year.
All right. Well, we're going to talk about the off-season look ahead for the four teams that were eliminated this weekend. We also have weekly awards coming up. But, we just talked some coaches, and perhaps you are in need of great talent for your business but short on time. Well, you don't have to get lost in a huge stack of resumes to find your perfect hire. You just need the right tools, smarter tools. That's where ZipRecruiter comes in. ZipRecruiter posts your job to over 100 of the web's leading job boards with just one click. Then ZipRecruiter actively looks for the most qualified candidates and invites them to apply. They even review every application to identify the top candidates, so you never miss a great match. That's why ZipRecruiter is different. Unlike other hiring sites, ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on the right candidates finding you. It finds them. No wonder 80% of employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site in just one day. Find out why ZipRecruiter has been used by businesses of all sizes and industries to find the most qualified job candidates with immediate results. And right now, our listeners can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/things. That's ZipRecruiter.com/THINGS. One more time, try it for free. Go to ZipRecruiter.com/things. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
Number nine.
All right, topic number nine here, Andy. We're going to run through the offseason. Let's call this the lightning round. Let's call this a lightning-ish round. Let's keep our branding intact. We're going to talk about the four teams that were eliminated this weekend. Let's start with the Titans. Look, I thought they were sort of looking for any excuse to move on from Mularkey and find their guy they were going to pair with Mariota. The reports, again, as we tape this, is that they have offered an extension to Mularkey, so it looks like he is going to stay. And that's surprising. And you know, he got a good response out of that team. They've rebuilt effectively, and they made the playoffs, and that's a very nice accomplishment. But just watching Mariota slide back, I mean, that has to be your number one priority, is getting Mariota on the right track, and it just seems like it's not, maybe not happening right now.
It's awfully quick, though, too. I mean, they've gone 9-7 with Mularkey a few years in a row. It's not a bad way to start out. Mm-hmm. Mariota is very good on play action, as we've seen the numbers play out, and you have to have him in a run-based offense. Mularkey has an expansive run-based offense. I didn't think Mularkey was very good in the divisional round in some of the game management, and that probably didn't – I thought maybe this will be the nail in the coffin on that, because the people making this decision – they're probably not true football people. It's members of Bud Adams' family, as I understand it. It's kind of scattered around. I don't know whose desk it falls on. But the perception was in the divisional round that Mularkey blew it at the end of the first half of the game management. I think he kind of did. But that happens. You know, that happens. And that should not override all the good things a coach does. And I think Mularkey's done a lot of good things. And I like that his system is so clearly defined. At least you have an identity there in Tennessee, and it's now a matter of getting better within the context of your identity, and that's a foundation. You can build on that.
Gut feeling, would you have tried to move on? Would you have tried to find someone new to pair with Mariota, or do you like the Mariota-Mularkey pairing going forward?
I like it. I like it going forward because I think Mariota's NFL success will come in a run-oriented offense, and Mularkey's willing to be creative with some of his running designs.
Okay. I will try to keep a more open mind on this going forward. Let's talk Falcons here.
Thank you.
Let's talk Falcons. They're getting better defensively. That's the good news. They're getting they got worse offensively. I mean, they weren't going to be as good in all likelihood, but they slid back. I thought they were particularly bad in their playoff games. Do you consider moving on from Steve Sarkisian, or do you stick with this and ride it out and say we're going to be better in year two because things take more than one season to improve?
I say that publicly for sure, and I probably keep one eye open for someone else who might be out there, because there are a lot of head coaching jobs still open, because they're probably going to Pat Shurmur and the two coordinators in New England, and maybe John DeFilippo, the Eagles QB coach, or someone else. But there's head coaching jobs open, which means there's going to be some dominoes falling, and maybe a name creeps up and becomes available. You're not going to find the next Kyle Shanahan, most likely, but I would keep an eye open. This should not be that long-term of a process. This was one of the 10 best offenses ever in history last year, and it came back with the exact same players this year, and it was not even one of the 10 best offenses in the NFL this year.
Yeah, I mean, it was barely one of the 10 best offenses in the playoffs this year. Steelers, I guess, you know, when you look at this, and you look what happened on Sunday, gosh, they miss Ryan Shazier at this point. Ben has announced there will be no drama this offseason. Ben Roethlisberger is going to come back for 2018. There'll be some stuff with Le'Veon Bell. I don't think they possibly let Le'Veon Bell get away at this point. I don't know how they rectify that, but I don't think he's going anywhere else. I guess you just have to figure out what you're going to do at that linebacker spot in the event that Ryan Shazier is not going to be able to play again.
Yeah, you got to go find someone. That's a hole in the roster, and a really unfortunate hole. And Bell, that'll be interesting to see. I don't know anything about his personality. You see what you see publicly, but I don't know if I believe him that he'll sit out or not. When I say that, I don't know. I mean, he might. He might sit out the whole year. His logic would be good for that. He's not going to take the pounding for not getting what he believes to be top dollar. I understand that. So we'll see how that saga plays out. I'm going to say one thing, Gary, I'm just stating the truth here, and I guess I'm kind of implying something, but I think Mike Tomlin's a great coach. I think they've got a great staff, and it's a stable system, and I am not saying at all that Pittsburgh needs to redefine itself. But this team went to the Super Bowl in 2010, and so did the Green Bay Packers, and both of these teams have had one of the three or four most talented rosters in the NFL that entire time since then. And those quarterbacks have been great and have gotten better since that 2010 Super Bowl, and neither of them have been back in another Super Bowl. And that's just that's baffling to me.
Yeah. Well, it's I mean, look, you have Tom Brady in the AFC, and you have a lot of good teams in the NFC. I could see how it happened, but it's you're right. It's disappointing. I don't know what you do. Let me just ask you real quick.
And look, there's something to be said for being in the playoffs every year.
Yes. That's not easy. I mean, the Packers weren't there when they lost their quarterback, and they have some rebuilding to do. But I wanted to ask you real quick. Le'Veon Bell, is in your mind, is he a guy who's going to age well? Because he is. I mean, look, he's taking a ton of hits. He's getting up there in age, a lot of wear and tear. Is he a guy, because of his unique running style or because of his versatility, is he a guy who maybe lasts longer than what you might think?
I think he could be. It's a matter of whether his body in and of itself can maintain the nuance that he has as a runner. Can he physically do that? Because I don't think he's taken much of a pounding. Chris Collinsworth made a great point a few broadcasts ago. I think it was in maybe the Baltimore-Pittsburgh Sunday night game, where he said Bell's unique running style, he doesn't take a lot of heavy blows because of the weird angles that defenders have to approach him at. He hasn't been hit super hard a bunch in his career. So he's a very agile runner. Even though he's willing to finish runs hard with authority, he's not taking reactionary hits, which is very different than delivering the hit. So mm-hmm. I could see him aging well. Let's also not get too far ahead. Here's the reality. Ben Roethlisberger is very much aging. Antonio Brown's in the prime of a Hall of Fame career. The defense is young and rising, but you never know. And that's their window's now. And their window's probably 3 years until being closed, maybe sooner. So you figure out a way to keep Le'Veon Bell on the roster right now, because this is what you do it for. You're in the NFL to have teams like this that can potentially get you to the Super Bowl. If you're not going to pay Le'Veon Bell top market, then who will you pay and for what reasons?
All right, and last team that went down this weekend, that was the Saints. Look, they have a they have something working defensively now. I don't know if they keep Dennis Allen, this offseason. It sounds like Allen's not really being connected to any of the jobs out there. So they might keep this defense together. You keep Drew Brees in town. I don't know. I don't know what kind of work they have to do to this roster. It doesn't seem like a team with any major holes at this point.
I agree with you. I think they're in a good spot heading into the offseason, and they can use their draft picks as luxury picks and build depth. Probably could stand to find another edge rusher, but other than that, they don't have any dire needs at all. Maybe cornerback depth, too, because you can never have too much of that.
Number 10.
The finale, the weekly awards for divisional playoff weekend. Offensive player of the week, who do you have?
I will go with, I loved the way Leonard Fournette played, but I'm going to go with Tom Brady. I thought Tom Brady owned that game against Tennessee, and I thought he also made some plays late in the down like he has all season, which still continues to amaze me.
All right, well, I'll just give it to Case Keenum for the throw that he made. Nice play by Stephon Diggs, too, but that was a big-time throw. Defensive player of the week, who do you have?
Defensive player of the week, I'm going to split it with Jalen Ramsey and A.J. Bouye. Even though I know they gave up a lot of yards passing. Great pick. I don't love the pick. But I thought those guys played much better than the stats indicate, so I will make a fool of myself to make that point proven. The guys that gave up 400-something yards passing, they're my defensive player of the week, damn it.
No need for the profanity there. But I'll give it to Fletcher Cox for as expected, sort of toying with the smaller humans on the Falcons' offensive line. That was a nice performance. Sort of a bit of a collective award for the Eagles, but I'll give it to Fletcher Cox. Special teams player of the week.
I'm going to double down on to feel better about the defensive pick, and I'm splitting it up. I'm going to do it this way, though. Bouye is my defensive player, and Ramsey, I assume, covered a kick or a punt or something somewhere in there at some point. I'm hoping. He was on the field for a snap. I'm giving it to him. Special teams player of the week, Jalen Ramsey.
Oh, so he kind of gets two awards in a week where he
No, I removed him from the defensive player.
He's out of the equation just for his special teams play.
Yeah. Bouye stands alone as defensive player of the week because these awards are so important, and Ramsey becomes a special teams player of the week because, as our listeners know, I do watch the special teams a little bit in the playoffs because the drama of it is fascinating at times, but I can't remember the guys. And, you know, the one guy, well, how about this? I'll change it up again. I'll go Kai Forbath for the Vikings because the way he holds his face, he looks like he's about to break down and cry at all times. And after he missed that first field goal, I thought, my God, he's going to cry right there on the field. And then as the game went on, I just realized that's how he holds his face. And so I was really rooting for him to make his field goals because I didn't want to see his face with a look of despair on it. I don't know if I could have taken that as a bystander. And Kai Forbath, I don't think he missed any field goals after that early miss.
This is my question for you. Is it his face or is it the shape of his face mask? I always thought it was the shape of his face mask that makes him look like that.
Yeah, it could be. Either way. I don't know. I've only seen his face behind the face mask. So it could very well be what you're describing. Yeah.
He that was a big kick he made, that 53-yarder. Wasn't easy.
Yeah, I guess so.
I thought when you paused and said you were going to give it to someone else, I thought you were going to give it to Taysom Hill, the single-digit special teamer for the Saints, the third quarterback.
Didn't that look like a preseason game with number 7 out there on the field playing like a kind of a defensive type of play?
I always think like, oh, my God, they had their punter out there covering a punt. And no, it's always just Taysom Hill, and yeah, he sort of forced that block. He didn't get the block, but he got in there and probably redirected Quigley's kick on that ended up getting blocked and setting up some points for the Saints. So
he's your guy then.
I guess he is because I was going to give it to Forbath.
Nope, I got Forbath
for also exercising the ghosts of Gary Anderson in Minnesota.
Yeah,
Coach of the Week. Who do you have, Andy?
Doug Peterson, Frank Reich, John DeFilippo for what he contributed, I'm sure. But that Eagles, whoever's behind the Eagles game plan, it's probably all those guys. That's who gets my vote for Coach of the Week.
Yeah. I'll give it to Nathaniel Hackett. sort of a lifetime achievement award for Blake Bortles. But yeah, I thought they dialed everything up at the right time. I thought it was a near perfect game for Hackett today, which is how you score 40 something points with Blake Bortles. But nice day for him.
Well, 30.
Oh, that's
Bortles.
Right, because they had yeah. the scoop and score. All right. Andy, that's a wrap. Thanks, as always, to producers Shelby Royston and Lou Pellegrino, helping us out with some tech problems on this Sunday night. Also, editor Chris Basil, going to make us sound good like the guys at Cadence 13 always do. But most of all, thank you to you guys for listening to this episode of the MMQB 10 Things podcast. Obviously, huge shows coming up. We're going to have a conference championship roundup next week, and then we'll have all sorts of Super Bowl stuff. We haven't decided exactly what, but it's going to be great. I will make that guarantee. Andy and I want to hear from you. If you have any ideas for the show, or you want to criticize, or you want to heap praise upon us, that's always nice. Andy_Benoit, GGremling_SI. If you're going Twitter, we're both on Facebook, or you can write into talkback@themmqb.com. Remember to listen and subscribe to new and archived episodes of the MMQB podcast with Albert Breer, the MMQB podcast with Peter King, and this show, the MMQB 10 Things podcast, wherever you listen to podcasts, including the MMQB.com, SI.com, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, TuneIn, and other podcast providers. We will see you guys next week. As regulation has officially expired on our podcast, there's no overtime in sight. I'll spare you the agony of more sports jokes. However, nothing hits the spot like some shut-eye after playing or attending a sporting event, and we think the same goes for listening to us talking about it. So let Mattress Firm help you drift off to dreamland. Simply put, your budget stretches further at Mattress Firm. Head to mattressfirm.com/podcast. to learn how you can turn your sleep into a true slam dunk.
Tip of the hat to Albert, another strong edition of MMQB. Did you know your favorite team has a daily podcast on the Locked On Podcast Network? Steelers fans, we have you covered with Locked On Steelers. Cowboys fans, it's Locked On Cowboys. And Chiefs fans, it's Locked On Chiefs. You get the picture. Search Locked On, your favorite team. Search on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts for Locked On, your favorite team. Or tell your smart speaker to play podcasts Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.